Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about the development of the Inca Empire, this very large territorial state incorporating a number of different cultures and different languages that stretched from the Pacific coast of South America across the Andes to the headwaters of the Amazon. Now, the Inca state was finally ended by the Spanish conquest of 1532. And it is really with this period, at the beginning of the 16th century, and the spread of European explorers and soldiers and merchants across the globe, that the world is brought into an increasingly global interchange. And so it's with that period that our survey of the independent development of states and civilizations in different parts of the world comes to an end. Over the last 47 lectures, then, we've surveyed world history through much of the last 10,000 years, seeking to understand the origins and developments of states and civilizations in different parts of the globe. We began with a vital consideration of why these processes are of such great interest to archaeologists and to the general public more widely. Why these are of such interest, and a consideration as well of the different models and theories of cultural change that archaeologists use to try and understand these developments toward the state, toward civilization. Of particular importance here have been the different evolutionary models that attempt to account for cultural and political change globally, or at the very least, perhaps, over large areas of the world. These models both structure archaeological assumptions and interpretations, and in turn are derived from those assumptions and interpretations. And this mutuality is extremely important. Whether the particular models are correct or not is an important issue, but I will note that this intimate and reflexive relationship between theory and data is central to any scientific discipline. And we archaeologists think of ourselves as scientists. Sometimes, because of popular portrayals, people are sometimes surprised to hear that this relationship exists in archaeology, although I will note that a short time ago, I saw the last Indiana Jones movie in a cinema. And I noted that one of the things that even Indiana Jones did in that film was he talked a little bit about theory, and he actually mentioned V. Gordon Childe, one of the important theorists of archaeology, who we've been talking about in this series of lectures. Now, mind you, he did it, I believe, after skidding along the floor of the Yale Library on a motorcycle. On the other hand, if Indy can be thinking about theory as an archaeologist, then there's hope for all of us. One of the most important elements in any archaeological study of ancient states and civilizations will be its comparative outlook. We simply will not be able to assemble a complete and convincing account of ancient civilizations if we don't understand how they developed through time in different environments, in different cultural and historical circumstances. We must have that comparative point of view. So, our comparative analysis took us, in turn, from Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley, where early and strikingly different forms of statehood had appeared almost simultaneously by the end of the 4th millennium BC. We went from there to the shores and the islands of the eastern Mediterranean with Levantine, Minoan, and Mycenaean states, where we again saw the development of still different forms of statehood, as well as, interestingly enough, perhaps ominously enough, our first large-scale example of civilizational collapse. We move from there to the Indus Valley in what's now India and Pakistan, where the Harappan civilization is relatively unknown to Westerners, including many archaeologists, and seems to be remarkably free of the panoply of elite display that we see in many other regions of the world. We went from there to China, where forms of governance that seem to have origins beyond the Shang dynasty were transmuted through many centuries, eventually to give rise to a tradition of government of extraordinary vigor and sophistication. We moved in turn to different parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where issues of trade and exchange seem to have played an especially important role in the development of states and civilizations in Aksum, in the inland Niger Delta of Mali, in the Lake Chad Basin, and at Great Zimbabwe. Now, it's possible that this is because this relative concentration on trade and exchange exists because we have fewer historical data on these cases, but it still is true that this orients us to the vital roles that trade relationships have played in ancient states. And then finally, we move to Mesoamerica and South America, where we saw the development of states and civilizations under somewhat different environmental and economic conditions than those found in the Old World, perhaps existing as well at different tempos, but where such states and civilizations are equally notable for remarkable achievements in architecture, in the large-scale organization of populations, and in ceremonialism and religious activity. So now, we're almost finished. What have we found out? Our comparative survey leads to a perhaps somewhat perplexing result. Although there are significant parallels in the ways in which states and civilizations developed in many areas of the world, there seem to be exceptions to almost any generalization that we can try to make. Ancient states originated in arid environments and in wet tropical forests. They seem to have been ruled hierarchically by despots, and perhaps in some cases heterarchically by councils of citizens. They built great cities, nor they did not. At the centers of their communities were temples and palaces, or perhaps such structures did not exist. They developed complex writing systems, or they were illiterate. This certainly strongly indicates that no rigid evolutionary model will fully explain the development of states and civilizations in different regions of the world. It simply is not going to do it. For a full account of different cases, we have to consider a variety of circumstances. We have to look at the diverse environmental and economic conditions in which particular states developed. We have to try and understand the particular cultural characteristics of the preceding societies in areas where they develop. Because it's obviously going to be the case that the nature of states and civilizations is going to depend to a very great degree on the characteristics of their predecessors. And those characteristics will only in part be determined by natural environments. And finally, and vitally, we have to try and understand the ingenuity, the initiatives, and the human frailties of the people who built those states and civilizations, both commoners and elites alike. We have to be able to understand, to some degree at least, how people approached this set of cultural and political circumstances. Of course, identifying such factors is a tall order for archaeologists, a real challenge for us, especially that last set of influences, human initiative, human action. Given that the archaeological detection of individual human activity is usually very difficult. But in fact, all of these factors in combination will help determine how the unique characteristics of every state and each civilization came to be. As I said, a tall order, a real challenge. It's going to be especially difficult to analyze these characteristics, these influences, during those periods when states were first developing, transforming themselves into political and cultural systems very different than anything that came before. Now, archaeologically, of course, this is one of the most interesting periods in the development of states and civilizations. In many ways, this is just the period that we should be concentrating on. That initial fluorescence, that transformation of society that results in a state. At this point, it seems as if we still find analysis and comparison of these, perhaps I can call them proto-states, very challenging. We've seen how frequently such societies are labeled by archaeologists as chiefdoms, an identification that sometimes seems to obscure as much as it reveals. One element that makes analysis of these societies, these transforming societies, especially challenging for archaeologists, lies in the fact that the rate of political change leading from earlier, less centralized, less hierarchical societies to states seems to be very different in different regions. In some cases, we could think here perhaps of Mesopotamia. We could think of the Pacific coast and highlands of Peru and neighboring areas, for example. These developments from earlier, less centralized societies towards states seem to happen gradually and relatively steadily over multiple centuries or thousands of years. In other areas, Egypt, perhaps, or in different parts of Mesoamerica, the tempo seems to be significantly more rapid. And so the transformation from egalitarian societies towards states seems to occur over the course of just a few centuries. And in a few cases, as for example in the Indus Valley, progress to the state may actually be really revolutionary. One of the interesting topics then for archaeologists is, why would tempos differ so much in different parts of the world? Why is it the case that this happens more quickly in some areas than others? We've learned a great deal about ancient states and civilizations over the last century. In some cases, through methodologies unimaginable at the beginning of this archaeological quest. And I've noted some of these advances in these lectures. I've talked, for example, about radiocarbon dating, the basis, in many ways, of archaeological chronologies today. I've talked about magnetometry survey and the potential for locating archaeological sites without excavation. I've talked about stable isotope analysis, which allows us to trace the migrations of individual people from the areas they were born to the places that they die. These advances in understanding seem set to continue. Not everywhere at once, and certainly not always at the same rate in different areas, but gradually. And they occur because of technological advance. So our advances in understanding certainly are in part tied to the technological sophistication of the discipline, but ultimately they result through the hard work of researchers across the globe. Because of this work, we can identify a number of themes, I believe, that seem to be important to the origins and development of civilizations in many different parts of the world. I'm not going to claim that these are universal. I'm not even going to claim that all archaeologists agree that all of these are important, but I believe that we could make a good argument that they're very important in many cases. So let's think about what these different elements might be. The first thing we could say is that the economic basis of ancient civilizations is obviously very important. And I'm not saying that just because I'm an archaeologist and I study material culture. The appearance and development of ancient civilizations involves the prior existence of an efficient and productive agricultural system, one that can support many people who do not themselves farm, but rather carry out other economic, political, or religious tasks. They are priests. They make pottery full-time. They are soldiers. They are pharaohs, perhaps. Of these early states, I will note, many appear in floodplain environments where intensive cereal agriculture, often but not always involving irrigation systems, can be undertaken on fertile alluvial soils. Now, this is not to say that irrigation systems or cereal agriculture are necessarily going to be essential to every state in every period of time. But we see a significant number of cases where that particular economic adaptation is quite successful and supports ancient states. The further growth of states frequently involves further intensification of these farming systems, and in general, involves significant increases in population. So we've got the economic system, increases in productivity in the economic system, tied to increases in scale of the state. This often takes the form of urbanism, the appearance of towns and cities enmeshed in elaborate settlement hierarchies. Urbanism, I have to emphasize this, leads to a corresponding appearance of rural areas. When people invent towns, they invent the countryside as well. Urbanism takes many forms, and it doesn't seem to be absolutely necessary for the appearance of states and civilizations everywhere in the world. I think we could argue, for example, that Olmec society in Mesoamerica was not urban, although the Olmec certainly did create extraordinary ceremonial centers. It remains entirely unclear whether these ceremonial centers were also places where very many people actually lived. So it's not necessarily the case that every ancient civilization is going to be urban. In general, though, we archaeologists are often surprised by the scale and complexity of urbanism associated with early states. Ancient states do not seem to have developed in isolation. And so another characteristic, an important characteristic that seems to reoccur, would be trade with surrounding regions, playing a vitally important role. In some cases, we know, this involved trade and exchange for staple goods, products necessary to basic economic activity. building materials in central Mesopotamia, for example, or salt in the inland Niger Delta, or perhaps honey in the Maya lowlands. It's likely that cases of such trade in staples were more common than we recognize, because so many such goods, food items or textiles, for example, do not preserve well archaeologically. Even more general, though, seems to have been a trade in various luxury goods. Of the myriad of different kinds, fine ceramics, jewelry, lovely textiles, precious metals, precious stones, and so on. Such goods are relatively easy to transport and of high value, so they don't require such elaborate trading networks as do bulk staple goods. As a corollary, if we're thinking about trade in luxury goods, we've often seen the appearance of regional cultural systems, especially associated with elite groups and with this trade and exchange in exotic luxury goods. This exchange of exotic luxury goods is really one of the material signatures of elites. These exist in Mesopotamia, in China, in Mesoamerica, and in many other areas. There are probably three factors behind the development of these regional networks of elites and of elite culture. The first of these factors would be competition between elites in different political centers. However, that competition, secondly, is existing within the context of broad regional agreement among these elites on how elite status is to be displayed, is to be materialized, is to be justified. You may be in competition, but these elites have to be playing by the same rules. And contributing to the trade in elite artifacts, the high status and aura of exoticism and cosmopolitanism that even today we often associate with goods that come from far away. These regional elite traditions, as I said, we've seen them in a variety of different areas, are often at the basis of what we call civilizations, cultural, political, and ideological systems that were shared between different states in a region. Again, states usually did not begin in splendid isolation. And when we talk of Mesoamerican civilization or Mesopotamian civilization, we're usually talking about cultural systems that are widely shared by those at the apex of power and wealth. The rich, the wealthy, the powerful, the elite, the nobility, the rulers. The culture of common peoples in different parts of such a civilization may actually be much more various. These regional civilizations often develop gradually, and we can probably trace very significant elements in Chinese and Mesopotamian civilization, for example, to processes going on in the Longshan and Halafian periods, respectively, many centuries before the initial appearance of states. One vital element in state formation around the globe seems to be its ideology, the various forms of religious and cultural justifications and explanations for civilization, along with the architecture and art styles and material items and ritual forms that make such ideology concrete and that gives archaeologists lots of work to do. These ideologies often work to naturalize the state, to make it and its rulers central elements in the divine order of things, sometimes literally, as when the Egyptian pharaoh or the Inca ruler were turned into a type of god. There's obviously an immense variety in the ways in which people in different regions have developed ideologies that support the workings of states and civilization, and probably in many areas, to resist states as well, which is really just as important. It's sometimes challenging for archaeologists to study ancient ritual and ceremonial systems, the basis of these ideological systems, because of their diversity and because their essence can be quite divorced, it might seem, from the analysis of material goods that archaeologists feel most comfortable with. Without or before written evidence, it can be hard to evaluate just how ancient ideological systems developed. However, the extraordinary spread and persistence of the elite Mesoamerican ritual system, with its pyramids and plazas and ball courts, with related themes and iconography, with common calendar systems, and even with common spatial orientations for buildings, testifies to the impact of a successful ideology. It lasted for over 2,500 years and was adopted by different cultures through much of the region between central Mexico and Panama. I'll note that the teaching company has an excellent course on archaeology of religion by John Hale, which goes into these issues in much more detail. We have different amounts of evidence for the bureaucracies that must have existed, even in very nascent, simple forms in early states. In many cases, what evidence we do have comes from written accounts, and writing systems exist in most of the early states that we've examined in the course of these lectures. It's perplexing, however, that different ancient civilizations seem to have put writing to very different uses, in claiming ownership, in accounting, in propaganda, in divination, and so on, while some grand and complex states like Teotihuacan and the South American states we looked at never get into the habit of writing at all. It may be, of course, that some of this diversity exists because certain kinds of writing existed on media that have not preserved through time. We've made a general dichotomy between city and territorial states and talked about the ways in which urbanism, trade, and market systems, bureaucracy, and territorial control existed in these different kinds of states. To be sure, this dichotomy between territorial and city-states is probably an oversimplification, but it remains a good way to think about the commonalities among states while recognizing and remembering the diversity that also exists across the globe. In fact, this complex relationship between commonality and diversity should be the primary theme for this course and for any serious study of ancient states and civilizations. We can't help but be awestruck at the diverse ways in which people in ancient societies created states and civilizations, and at the ingenuity and effort that they invested in supporting those states. At the same time, and as scientists, archaeologists look for common patterns in the development of ancient states and civilizations, seeking to understand the complex relations between environments, economies, technologies, religious and political systems, and the outcomes of human initiative and endeavor. We do all of this, of course, mostly by studying the material traces of human existence, from high art and monuments to the garbage people leave behind, but mostly and increasingly and powerfully the latter, the garbage. As I said in my very first lecture, I'm entirely confident that future researchers will eventually render some of the things I've said in these lectures obsolete. I hope and expect that. But that very fact itself is one of the things that makes doing archaeology interesting and even fun, the constant excitement and challenge that comes from new discoveries and new theories. I hope that you've enjoyed hearing about this kind of archaeological investigation as much as I enjoy talking about it and as much as I enjoy doing archaeological research. Thank you very much.